Welcome to eHealth Learning, inspiring professionals worldwide.
So as I was mentioning to you earlier, we had a book launch yesterday on The Breath of Life with Cherry Ona Menzem-Sills from the biodynamic perspective of craniosacral therapy. So this week has got a theme of breath, and Philip and I were just discussing some of the notable marks in my book on the breath. And I shared a simple introduction webinar bringing in some of Philip's excerpts from this book and some other approaches earlier in the year. And so it's lovely to bridge the two by the supporting processes of the human breath. And tonight we chose, didn't we, Philip, to bring this to the context of our audience tonight, which are a lot of different types of body workers. And you've mentioned this approach of releasing the body to the breath rather than the mind over matter practice of directing the breath to do a certain thing based on what we think it should be doing, perhaps. Yesterday was on this wider context of the breath of life. And I was saying to Philip, there are some excerpts from the book that really, for me, speak to how we are connected by larger processes in life, and that our breath itself is supported by those and by nature itself and the planets and cosmos and wider still. So for me personally, that was a lovely link between the two subjects from yesterday to today. It's lovely to have you back, Philip, and to talk about this book that I'm so fond of, carry with me. Would you open by just telling the audience a little bit about the difference perhaps between this book and the first one and what came into being to write the second book, and then take us away with something directly to do with the relaxation, releasing the body to the in-breath, releasing the body to the out-breath maybe?
Yeah, my first book was New Self, New World. It took me 10 years to write it. And it's a large, large overview that was intended to help locate us in the arc of history, in the evolution of consciousness, where we are now. And, it actually looked at how our bodies and our relationship to our bodies become the template for all our relationships in the world. And we began 8,000 BC in the late Paleolithic, early Neolithic, with a sense of the self, a sense of thinking, a sense of our awareness of the world from the belly. So we experienced our thinking in the belly. And then you trace how that rose up through the body with the advent of the Neolithic Revolution. And today we're sort of at the apex of that, where we've risen so far into our heads that our lives are abstract and we're not even aware of the option of dropping that center of awareness back down and reuniting with the body's intelligence, because we've so committed ourselves to the male pole of our consciousness, to that capacity for thinking in the abstract, which is the specialty of the head's intelligence, that we don't even realize that the body has a unique intelligence that is complementary to that abstract thinking. So New Self, New World was a sort of large picture of that, with some very specific things, practices that can bring us back to the body's intelligence and awaken our awareness of how connected it is to the world around us. Radical wholeness, instead of looking at a big thing, it looks at one specific thing. And that is our culture's loss of wholeness. To the extent that we, in the book, I actually say we are blind to wholeness. That may seem like a a rash statement because we shop at Whole Foods and we do holistic medicine and we're holistic this and that. But we gravely misconceive wholeness. We believe that, for example, my wholeness is found within the confines of my skin. And we, you know, we encourage people to be whole in body, mind, and spirit. And, you know, it's a lovely sentiment, but it's deeply misguided, because at the core of that sentiment is the notion that, well, you know, there are these three aspects to the self, body, mind, and spirit. And if you allow each of them to flourish and come into balance, you will be whole. And that sort of leaves the rest of the cosmos out of the picture, as though your wholeness were not innately bound to the present, to the world around you, as though your wholeness could be found in isolation from the world. So our understanding of wholeness is something that is found in isolation from the world, leads us to feel independent from the world. And the fallout from that is pretty catastrophic, because once you feel independent and strive for independence, you are taking on the aspirations of the tyrant. And the tyrant's aspirations were nicely summarized by Joseph Campbell, who said, well, the tyrant is the man of self-achieved independence. And to our ears, you know, that sounds pretty good, self-achieved independence, you know, make the millions and buy that mansion on the hill. And it's a deeply, deeply corrupt state of being. And you can see that. I mean, the more you strive for independence, the more alienated you feel, the more disconnected you feel, the more alone you feel in the world. And those are exactly the symptoms of our society that are creating such strife. Depression, I mean, the prime characteristic of depression is how alone you feel in the world. So as soon as, here's the cascade of effects. As soon as you feel alone in the world in that way, you believe that your experience is private rather than shared. The experience you're having now, you take to be your private experience, which it is, but it's also shared. It's shared with the room around you, the people around you. There is no experience that is not shared. But if you feel it to be your private experience, then your primary job in life becomes to supervise that experience, to make it as good as you can, to make it successful, to make it right, to make it feel good, to not fail in some way. And as soon as your primary job in life is to supervise your experience, you live in a state of continuous self-consciousness. You are conscious of the self, of the thoughts, of your emotions, and that window on the world contracts. It becomes obscured, because your focus is on the self. And I mean, our self-obsessed culture, you know, is a testament to that. And you know, it's not that long ago in my, you know, I heard John F. Kennedy extol the citizens of the United States. Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. That, I don't know of an American politician alive who would dare say those words, because the whole zeitgeist is for the self. And when your primary relationship is with yourself, your primary relationship in life is with the self, then the world, the guidance of the world, the companionship of the world, evanesce. They just disappear. It's like you take the spotlight of your attention and you turn it on yourself, and you cast the world around you into darkness. So radical wholeness really explores what that quality of wholeness, what the true nature of wholeness is. The true nature of wholeness is without boundary. Well, then, if you are to surrender to your wholeness, you are surrendering to an experience that is without boundary, that is informed by everything around you. And, you know, the role that breath plays in that, I don't think it can be overestimated. Breath, it's the primary means by which we connect with, feel, inhabit our being. And again, I have to be careful, you know, I talk about my being, and the listener is likely to interpret that as me talking about what is contained within my skin. But my being is not contained within my skin. My being is what I discover when I'm fully present. So my being in this moment includes you, includes the room around me, includes the sunlight filtering through my windows. My being includes all of that and is informed by it and shaped by it. And it's that larger sense of being that from which I derive my sense of being, not as something in isolation, but as something that is at rest in this present moment. And breath is what reveals that. And the connection, you know, when I take a breath into my body, I'm literally pulling into my body the exhalations of forests. And those exhalations become my body. They enter the cells of my body and nourish them. And then a gift is offered in exchange as I breathe carbon dioxide out that in turn nourishes the forests. So there is no discontinuity between self and world. In that sense, the world is forever passing through my body. My very experience of being is upheld. My very reality is upheld by that exchange with the world. We live in such a top-down culture. We're so stuck in our heads that our very experience of the breath has become a top-down phenomenon. So, you know, we try to get a handle on, you know, what the right way to breathe is. And we basically, any idea about what the right way to breathe is going to be, is going to manhandle the body and the body's intelligence to make that come about. So I don't subscribe to the notion that there is a right way to breathe. But there's a principle that guides my work. And that principle basically suggests that the whole of the body should be available to the breath. And what I mean by that is something very specific. When the breath wave enters the lungs, the whole of the body responds to it. I mean the whole of the body. I mean right down into the pelvic bowl. I mean right down through the legs to the feet, out the arms to the fingertips, to the top of the head. That breath wave passes through the whole of the body. And then the issue is the whole of the body available to the breath or not? And in our culture, you know, we emphasize the thoracic diaphragm in breathing because it is so subject to our will. And there are other diaphragms in the body. The pelvic floor is one of those diaphragms. So the thoracic diaphragm can be moving away, and the pelvic floor beneath it can be locked up in habitual tension, unmovable. So this is happening, and there is no response from the pelvic floor. When the in-breath is initiated from the pelvic floor, the thoracic diaphragm follows along. You can't release the pelvic floor to the breath without the thoracic diaphragm joining in. So the pelvic floor is inclusive, not just of the thoracic diaphragm, but of the whole of your being. And that brings us to that issue that you mentioned. We want, you know, our breathing tends to be top down. We know it's important to have a deep breath. We're taught that that's healthy. And so we push the breath down into the body as far as we can. And that takes muscular effort. The muscles get tired and the breath goes shallow again. But it's so contrary to the body's intelligence. It's contrary to the way a baby breathes in its crib. I mean, I could stand in the crib for half an hour and just feel a baby breathing. And you can see the whole of the body releases to the in-breath and releases to the out-breath. And the distinction is really crucial because the in-breath is initiated not with muscular effort. It's initiated with a release. You can release the body to the in-breath and release the body to the out-breath. And the quality of that release is a letting go. It's like, it's the way you'd release a leaf to a breeze and you let it go. And as you release the body to the in-breath, you don't know where that's going to take you. As you release the body to the out-breath, similarly, it will take you someplace and you don't know where, but the very act of releasing the body to the in-breath is at the same time a release of the body to the present. And there you have it, the conduit, you know, the breath as this conduit of exchange between what we experience as the body and the world around us, each becoming the other with every breath.
Beautiful.
And I could talk about how I experience that release, because to say release the body to the in-breath within our cultural paradigms is not readily understood. It is so not top down. You know, people listening, if you're sitting on a chair and you move to the front of the chair, so you're sort of juggled to the front of the chair, and you tilt the sitting bones back, so there's a slight arch in the back. That puts the pelvic floor in contact with the chair seat. And the pelvis, the whole pelvic bowl, is like a balloon. As the breath comes into it, it expands. As the breath releases, it settles back. And if you bring your attention to the pelvic floor, on the in-breath, you may feel it gently nudge down into the chair seat. It's a subtle sensation. But it gently pushes into the chair seat on the in-breath and gently rises on the out-breath. And that gives you a sense, a really tangible, palpable sense of the relationship between the pelvic floor and the breath. And then if you sort of forcefully, for the moment, push the air out of your body, so you're really breathing out, and then you just let go of all that musculature that's pushing the body out, you are releasing the body to the in-breath. So the breath, you know, you push the air out of your body, out, as much air as you can, and you just let go. The breath drops into your body, not because you're muscling it, but because you're releasing to it. And as you do that, you may feel the pelvic floor drop. You breathe out, push all that air out, and you drop, and the pelvic floor drops. So the pelvic floor supports the out-breath by moving slightly up into the torso, and then it releases to the in-breath. And as the pelvic floor releases to the in-breath, the whole of the body releases to the in-breath. And again, it's really contrary to the way we've been led to think about the breath. There is no right way to breathe. The body knows, it's known from the moment of your birth, how to open itself to the breath. And to activate that intelligence and to step back from it and allow yourself to experience it is to allow yourself, in a much larger sense, to come to rest in the present.
Thank you for sharing that. It reminds me a little bit of the one thing you said on your course. We can become aware of if we're in presentation or resting in presence. And the preconceived aspect of how we should breathe as practitioners and how our clients should be breathing could become part of that practitioner knowing from the mind of method. So I just saw another relevance there on if we do work with the breath in our practice, how this inquiry of breathing like a baby and enjoying releasing the breath to the body to the in-breath and releasing the body to the out-breath brings us to the present moment and can bring us into relationship with these kind of things we may have taken for granted that day in, day out, we teach other people how to breathe. From a, you know, presenting to the world a model of breathing, and you have an awareness of how available is my body to the breath, how available is my client's body to the breath, and some things that people do as body workers could bring freedom to the breath to move more freely through the body and express itself more fully, which is beautiful. But it's a different way of exploring and supporting the fullness of the breath through the whole of the body rather than training and presenting to our clients a way of breathing.
Yeah, and even, you know, in terms of modeling, even to move beyond information that's being consciously translated, as a practitioner, every time you speak to your client, you're modeling a way of being, whether you know it or not. Now, voice is a very complicated thing in human affairs because we innately know that when we speak, the whole of our being is revealed for all to hear. If your body's tight, that's heard. If it's anxious, that's heard. And what we tend to do is we tend to contract and try to control the voice, which means we are contracting and controlling the breath. And in speaking to a client, if your voice is, in that sense, controlled and disconnected from the body's intelligence, you're modeling a disconnected mode of being. So I can offer a principle that I'm hoping will land. When the breath releases from the whole of the body, it has the quality of a sigh. So, you know, when you sigh and you feel your calves and your glutes and your back and the top of your head and your arms, the whole of the body releases on a sigh. So then what happens when we speak? I tend to speak on a sigh because it feels so irritating when I don't, when the whole of my body isn't present to my voice. But, you know, I can speak like this, and this is how we're taught to speak. It's what we hear modeled around us. And I'm speaking from about, you know, 10% of my body, and I'm controlling everything. And I think I'm doing a great job and delivering a whole lot of information in a very, very clear fashion. Ah! But that is what is modeled for us. That is, you know, since we were babies, we have heard people speak in that, what I call, presentation mode, where the body's intelligence is supervised and managed, and the breath, you know, it begins with the breath, and the breath is compromised and chaperoned to communicate in a way that is ultimately manipulative. And I, you know, it's kind of a harsh thing to say, but I think it's important to recognize that we, as infants, what we most deeply crave is the love of those around us. We crave approval. We yearn to be seen. And that, I think, that is the deepest drive in infancy. And over again in our infancy, in some ways subtle and not so subtle, we begin to learn that the whole of our being is unacceptable. And what is necessary is to learn how to present ourselves in a way that will win the approval, will win the love. And so we compromise ourselves in order to elicit those qualities. And that presentation mode, that commitment to presenting yourself in a certain way, presenting your opinions to in a way that will garner respect or approval or whatever it may be, carries into adulthood unchallenged because it's being modeled all around us. And we speak to someone and present ourselves, and that the very urge to do that is taking you out of the breath and out of the present in order to manipulate a response from the person you're speaking to. You want them to trust you. You want them to agree with you. You want them to like you, whatever it might be. So presentation mode is always manipulative, and it always takes you out of the breath. And the risk, you know, you can feel the risk of what does it mean to just allow the breath to leave my body unchaperoned, unmanaged, in a sigh, as I'm speaking these words. And there's that sense, you know, initially of being like exposed and unguarded, but in fact you are allowing your being to live to the fullest extent possible in this moment. And what your client yearns for ultimately is for you to be present to them. That's what they want. And if you're in presentation mode, you're compromising your ability to be present with them.
I love how you've put that, Philip. It's for that reason that I really encourage practitioners within eHealth and wider to experience your work, to read the book, because it's very experiential and written from an embodied perspective that's for me, very full on to read and beautiful to read. And for that gentle noticing of presentation mode, as you just described, that it comes with us into adulthood, and it comes very much with us into practice when we have to earn money from doing whatever it is that we do. So we've learned to go along with this contracted sense of self, which is by its nature seeking connection and manipulating from a reduced capacity what goes on outside of itself. And then if we carry that without blame into the role of the practitioner, we're hoping that our clients get better. We're hoping that they like our touch, if we're touch professionals, or that the nutritional advice we give them works for them. We're motivated usually in practice by these things, but the way that we've carried our breath and our presence into practice is often implicated by this patterning to operate from, like you said, the availability of your voice to contracted and talking with part of our being. And the longing, the real work that shows up, I feel, when I've been with practitioners and there's that sense of presence, is just that they are fully available and present to me. And that is enough. So it's very liberating, whilst challenging as a practitioner, to consider the two, to consider I can be of deepest service to myself and others to be present, and I can surrender myself from needing to know and model. And the responsibility of bringing awareness to the modeling that takes place and the manipulation that leads to in our professional practice, where we're probably motivated by wanting to help others. So we can be more authentic to ourselves and our clients by exploring the breath and the fullness of our being to availability, and how our voice is modeling a replication of our availability of the body to the breath. I think it's fundamental and a really juicy and important bridge to explore this kind of work with you, for people who carry work to other beings for transformative and health. So beautiful.
There's another aspect to that, if we have time.
Yeah, we do. We're about halfway through, so I'd just like to bring awareness to people to pop some questions, if you have them, for Philip around his book and the embodied breath tonight, our topic of the night, relating to his book, Radical Wholeness, in the chat area in Zoom or on Facebook in the comments, and I will bring them to Philip. But yes, we have plenty of time.
I just wanted to note that one of the cornerstones of the client relationship is trust. That you know, that bond of trust is really what every modality builds on. It's what supports the client in their journey. And you know, when you stop the breath, when you no longer allow the intelligence of your being to be present, that contracted sense of self is inherently defensive. And if you are communicating to your client that you don't trust yourself, you know, there's that little kind of implication that you're not, that there's some reason you're not to be trusted. And they feel that, I mean, some more than others, but honestly, to allow yourself to be fully present to the client, to see them from that place of presence, is to already begin to build a foundation of trust.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I might, you know, while we're on the breath, I mean, there's so much we could explore. Our culture is so biased to the front of the body, to showing up, to being up front, to whatever it is. we tend to pull the breath into the front of the body. And the reservoir, the ground of the breath, is in the back. And there is so much capacity for the aliveness of the back to the breath. And we forget that. And, you know, it's a really useful thing to become aware of the ability of the back to open to the breath and release to it. And as the breath begins to move into the back, as the back awakens to it in that way, your awareness begins to shift more deeply into the body, out of the front, to this foundation of support in the back. Even, you know, even if you put your hand on your back, just, you know, wherever the listeners are at the moment, as you breathe into the back, you'll likely feel the movement of the back with the breath. And if you see, we are cued by our culture to notice the breath. And there's so many modalities that encourage us to basically sit in the head and notice the breath. But there's a very real sense in which you are your breath at this moment. It is not something that is happening to you. It is you. It is your life. And as you feel the breath in the back, there's the ability to shift your awareness so that it moves behind the body and sits there in this solid foundation of awareness. And then all that, the social cueing that puts us into presentation mode, you're sort of backing off that. And you are seeing from the back and hearing from the back and feeling from the back. And there is a stillness that is made possible in your being by that awareness. And I don't think you can move the awareness of the breath into the back without the back being alive to the breath. I think it's the very aliveness of the back to the breath that gathers that awareness and allows you to sit in it.
Mm-hmm. I'm enjoying breathing into my back.
Yeah. And then, you know, again, for practitioners, to feel that awareness in the back, to be aware from there, then what does it mean to speak from that awareness, which is very different from speaking from our faces, which is what we tend to do, or, you know, having the sense that the voice is centered around the sternum somewhere. And to feel the breath in the back and allow your words to arise from that place, it's just a very different experience. And it's one that is arising from your being rather than from your, you know, very skillful knowledge of presentation mode.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
There's a form of the Nishino method. There's a form of breathing that I love. That was developed by a guy, Kozo Nishino, in Japan, who was a dancer and a martial artist and like really interesting guy. And he was in the middle of a sparring match with someone who was really strong and skillful. And something happened and he threw the guy. And he began to think back, what was that happened? And he realized that in that moment, he allowed his breath, or the sensation of his breath, to enter the body through the soles of his feet. And he took the breath in from the soles of the feet, and it went right up to the head, and then from the belly, it released down through the legs and out the soles of his feet. And we in our culture treat our legs as prosthetics. We so dissociate from their intelligence, from their intention, from their awareness of the world. And so that, to play with that, to feel the breath drawn into the body through the soles of the feet. And he speaks of it coming right up to the head, and then there's this little pulse just below the belly button that sends it down through the body and out the soles of the feet. And the more gently you play with that, the more you begin to gather the intelligence of the legs into the intelligence of the body. And without that intelligence of the legs, we cannot be grounded. You lose that thrumming connection to the earth and all the information through the soles of the feet that help locate you in the present here and now. I sort of interrupted. You were going to say something, but I plowed through.
No, it's beautiful. I was just at the beginning of tonight's call. I mentioned that you were in the middle of three now, or the ones about to begin, practitioner trainings. And I'm just wondering if people might be interested to, because I know when I came to Ireland, there was a Alexander technique practitioner and a craniosacral practitioner who were very much in love with the work, shall we say, or with what this was revealing to them in their practice and for their own journey and embodied process. So it resonates strongly with some of the craniosacral descriptions of what, when they widen their perceptive field to the edges of the room and to the horizon. This is very much the language of some of the beautiful teachings which I was exposed to through the bodywork degree. Michael Kern, Michael Shea, Howard Evans, different teachers of mine that I met or worked with. And there's a return to that in the expansion of receptivity we experience more in your work. So I feel it really lends itself to exploring and liberating us from the notion of presenting anything, but enriching what we already love to do and finding a new way to orient in our work and in our life. And the way you share that with people feels so trust oriented, so safe and so gentle. That it's not to cast a judgment upon our conditioned ways of being or presentation mode, but just noticing when it shows up and having really skillful ways, because it's difficult to describe your work without experiencing it. So I'm trying to do a little bit of that without presenting about it, but in my body, it feels ways of, you actually call them sandboxes, don't you? Like these giant play arenas for adults. But it's like that, like sifting through sand with the hands and seeing what shows up, the bigger nuggets of stone or toys that are in the sand that might be familiar, and then looking at them and seeing, does this still serve me or can I let it go? Feels like the process of the embodied present. I mean, I only did the 4 days, but I found you noted that I seemed to soften over the few days. I felt that it was safe to notice, and that the group field was in support of the noticing so richly that it was safer and safer to notice more and more, and to and through the noticing in that support, I think you said, you know, the change is already in flow. Whereas if we notice and label it and say, this is bad that I'm doing this, or I've been teaching people to breathe, how wrong is that? Then again, we might then reject the notion of doing it a different way, again, to return to what we're used to. But my invitation to people is to enjoy and to experience your work. Whichever form that may take. We have a question.
Do you have an experiential way to activate, sensate, and bring awareness to the legs? That's a great question. I would say, even where you're sitting now, especially if you have your shoes off, if you just very, very gently lift one toe and see what comes up for you, or very gently press down with the toes into the floor. So to engage the musculature in a very subtle open-ended way, it often activates memories. So, you know, as I press my toes gently into the floor, a memory of sand, my feet being in sand, is brought back. My feet remember what it is to walk naked in snow. They've got that memory there. They know what it is to be in water. They know what it is to kick in water. All that memory is alive in my feet, in my legs. And to begin with something as simple as that, you are activating the sensitivity of the feet. And what happens is, you know, when we walk, we are so used to telling our legs what to do. It's such a different thing to, you know, gently activate the sensitivity of the feet and then stand up. And what, you know, where would it take you if you allowed the legs to move as they needed to, as, you know, whatever impulse is there to surrender the sort of top-down management of the legs and allow their inclinations, their wishes, their desires, their memories, their cravings, their urges to just live and show you something. So that it's taking the hierarchy, the top-down hierarchy, and turning it upside down, and the legs become the teacher. And they reveal lifetimes of memory and realms of sensitivity. And there is at the core of the legs such a deep understanding of intention. They feel the intention to run. They feel the intention to stretch or open or lift, whatever it may be. And, you know, again, you know, you can go for a run and say, oh, I should run now to keep up my, you know, my weekly routine, whatever it is. Or you can surrender to the legs and connect with their innate desire to move, because the body wants to move, the legs want to move. We don't have to go to the gym in a punitive way and make them move. You can go and unleash the body. And by unleashing the body, you are tapping into its intelligence and letting it live and letting it show you things. So you know, the subtlest little movement of the foot begins to awaken the sensitivity of the legs, and then how to heed that and nourish that and bring it into harmony with the whole of your intelligence. We're so accustomed as a culture, we've been taught that it's better, it's more efficient to think with a tiny segregated portion of our intelligence, the intelligence in the head, than to think with the intelligence of our entire being. And you think of that, and you think, why would it be better? Why would I think more clearly with a broken off segment of my intelligence than with the intelligence of the whole of my being? But you know, you think of the time you spend in school, years. I mean, the school system has you for years and years, and you sit there all day long, and the body's energy is to be suppressed. And the body's energy is an expression of the body's intelligence. So the body's intelligence becomes verboten, and if it's allowed to live, it will get you in trouble. And in the meantime, you're supposed to fill your head with the right ideas. And, you know, it's not that they have us for a few days or even a few months. They have us for 11, 12 years, teaching us that lesson that you can think more clearly with a little part of your intelligence broken off from the whole than you can with the whole of your being. It's one of the deepest fallacies of our culture.
Which you name as a primary wound of our culture, huh? The cleavage of thinking from being.
Yeah. I think it, to grow up in our culture, it's impossible to escape that wound that separates our thinking from our being. And then, you know, you begin to look at what does it mean to bring your thinking and your being back together. And in my experience, what it means is that I feel every thought. So my thoughts, it's like they echo through the whole of my being and gain clarity from that enable me to speak from that place of clarity, rather than from a place of disconnected striving. And not only do I feel my thoughts, but every sensation in the body is recognized as a form of thought. The body is processing and thinking and feeling and attuning. I think of the body as a resonator. I think of the body as a bell that rings to the truth of the present, feels it and rings to it. And in our culture, we tend to stuff that bell full of cotton balls, and it loses its ability to ring. It just becomes dull. And when you cannot feel the present, the truth of the present through the body, the truth of the present itself disappears from sight, and you no longer believe it even exists. And then the only recourse you have is to supervise the self, because the guidance of the world has been obscured from sight. And so much of the work of the breath is about feeling those obstructions in the body and learning how to integrate them so that ultimately the body contains enough spaciousness, not just for the breath, but for the whole of the world to live there. There's an African culture, the Anglo-Ewe, that I write about in Radical Wholeness. And they have a radically different sense of what our senses are. So we have the five senses, and you know, we all know that we know them all too well, and we believe that those are our senses. And you go to another culture like the Anglo-Yabe, and it's like they have a completely different understanding and experience of the senses. And they don't really have a word for senses, but what they have is a word, sesalalame, that's translated as feel at flesh inside. And they feel the sights of the world in the body. They feel the sounds of the world in the body. And they have that attunement to the guidance that is there. And, you know, you contrast feel at flesh inside with our culture. And our culture is about think at head inside. And we think that will solve our problems, that will win the day, that will lead to the successes we cherish. And it's a path that is divorced from wholeness. Whatever you undertake in this life, in this world, will be supported by wholeness, not impaired by it. And to break yourself into those compartments, into that fractured state, in the belief that it's a road to success is a really unfortunate byproduct of our attachment to living in the head.
Yeah. Speaking, I've heard you speak about the culture and the chosen five before, but as you were speaking today, it reminded me of the B&B I was staying in when I did the 4 days in Ireland, and how I became aware in my sleep of the rain and of giant bodies of water in the landscape. And as you were speaking, I was wondering if it was a slowing down. But if we just notice the thought of the cortical thinking of, I wonder if there are lakes around, but we disconnect from the intelligence of the body and being that felt the lakes around, then we think that it's, then we're thinking at the head within or the head above as owning this knowledge that popped in from nowhere. But it was really like a slowing down, because that awareness came in gradually and slowly in my sleep and then woke me up. And I just knew there were lakes that I hadn't seen behind hills that I'd driven between and not seen the lakes. So experiencing more and having more receptivity from just those 4 days with you, it could be seen that like the thought slowed down. It was traveling through my being or awareness to my mind that could name it as a thought that, oh, I'll ask the group in the morning, are there lakes around here? But I didn't need to ask. That information came to me. So it wasn't that it was slowing it down. It was just that I was feeling it coming in through the different aspects of perception and noticing. And I hadn't realized that till you just described how the different culture experience the different senses. And of course then they have a different sense of self, because we orient and separate with these chosen five. You speak about the chosen five in Western science, of our five senses in the West, and literally how we orient ourselves to what we're noticing changes vastly if we just open to, wow, there could be another sense that are, you know, proprioception, interoception are just words attempting to approach the wisdom of feel at the flesh within, of the vastness of sensation and intelligence in the body.
Yeah. And when you say they have a different sense of self, anthropologists have described what they perceive as the Anglo-Ebe sense of self. One anthropologist talked of the porosity of personhood, which is the exact opposite of our contraction into independence. Another anthropologist spoke of their radical indeterminacy of the self. Radical indeterminacy of the self. I mean, to us, that sounds like a nightmare, right? Because you have to know who you are and establish that, and that's how you move forward. And their culture is so permeable to the present that they're able to be changed by it. And what the present brings up is felt in them and moves through them and moves them. It's just such a different availability.
What's that sentence? So we're about there with time for today. What's that sentence about? The normal grace of being or the simple grace of being?
The subtitle of Radical Wholeness is the embodied present and the ordinary grace of being.
There it is in front of me on the desk. Beautiful. Yeah. This extrication from undeterminacy and flow and walling off of the sense of self robs and deprives us of so much that it is missed and overshadowed by the monitoring and self-regulation. So I love that ordinary grace of being as a barometer to presentation and presence. Yeah. If we're not experiencing, if we're presenting, then it's not ordinary. It's managed, and we try and make it special. And then if it's grounded and resting, it seems to have that ordinariness, and it's not trying to manipulate. So I love those words, and I've been missing them off the front of the cover of the book. So we've got some lovely thanks and lovely feedback coming in from Facebook and from other angles and emails, thanking you, Philip, for joining us again tonight and sharing, talking about the embodied breath and in relation to Radical Wholeness, your beautiful book. And I urge people to explore, check out philipshepherd.com for Philip's events. I'll be hosting him here in Portugal in March. I think we said the 2nd and 3rd, the weekend of...
I think the 9th, 10th, I think it was.
Okay, one of those weekends. But we'll...
It's on my website anyway.
It'll be on the website. So early March in Portugal, in Lisbon, and many other tour dates before then. And the three trainings which I would love to do at some point when it next comes around in a place in the world that I can access. I will be on one. Wonderful. So thank you so much. It was so rich and so beautiful to have you back again, Philip. And
always such a pleasure, Julian. You know that. I just love it.
Thank you so much. And we'll be in touch soon. And you'll be able to enjoy this webinar and share it. It's not going anywhere. It's going to stay here and be available on Vimeo soon to share freely, because it's a book launch and we want the world to receive Philip's beautiful book. And this webinar is an attempt in that direction to share it wider and with more beautiful people. So thank you all for coming. And any questions you have, you can put in the community group and we can discuss and share as a community. Do you have, Philip, a page or a group for... I know I'm part of, because I did a workshop with you, but do you have a community group or page on Facebook? You must have something.
Well, what I have is my professional Facebook page, Philip Shepherd. And there's lots of discussion and things posted there, and it's a pretty active forum. Yeah.
So we'll welcome you back anytime. And in the thread of tonight's webinar, perhaps as more and more people watch it, some things and questions may come up. If you do have time to stop by, you'd be very welcome. We're getting a lovely number of views now on these webinars. So it's a thrill to have you back as we're growing to reach more people with your book and tonight's webinar.
Yeah. Julian, thank you so much.
Thank you, Philip. Good night.
All the best.
Thank you.